Bien, bienvenue à tous de nouveau dans cet amphithéâtre du Collège de France pour la quatrième et dernière, malheureusement, conférence du professeur Shaughnessy, qui sera consacrée aujourd'hui aux versions donc exhumées aux manuscrits donc exhumés des tombes du Tao Te Ching, et vous aurez tout de suite remarqué donc l'inversion de l'ordre traditionnel dans l'intitulé donc de la conférence. Donc aujourd'hui, le professeur Shaughnessy devrait parler pendant une heure, et nous espérons avoir quelques minutes ensuite pour quelques questions très très brèves. Merci.
Thank you very much. I'm back to wearing proper clothing today, even though my youngest daughter was very very much opposed to it, and so. No other apologies to begin today's lecture, but I do want to start by expressing my thanks first to Professor Cheng and to the Collège de France. They've been splendid hosts during this month. To Professor Olivier Ventour of the École Pratique, who hosted a meeting last week. To Cyril Javary of the Centre Joly, and they have been very very keen attendance to the lectures and hosted me at their centre, and to all of you who have come to these lectures, it's a topic. Professor Cheng just said the topic next door is some abstruse topic. But actually, it's on the modern life of dot-coms, which I think is a very popular topic. This, on the other hand, is truly, truly an abstruse topic. The one that I hope, through the course of these lectures, I've given some sense of the vitality of the topic, at least in China, and I think also in the Western world, that these new discoveries have revitalized the field, if it needed revitalized, and I'm not sure that it did need revitalized, because these texts were written, in many cases, 3,000 years ago, but they've never stopped being read by people. So, the text today is a non-canonical text, at least in terms of the Confucian canon, though a classic nonetheless. And it was the first book that I studied in Taiwan almost 40 years ago, and my teacher there insisted on burning incense as we read the text, because it too is a classic, and the classics need to be respected. Though perhaps I'm not showing it respect here, because I have... for those of you who know this text, you might notice that I've changed the title of it a little bit. Instead of referring to it as the Tao Te Ching, the classic of the way and virtue, I'm referring to it in the title as the classic of virtue and the way, the Te Tao Ching, which is the way that we'll see that it's referred to in the excavated text. As I have done with the other three lectures, I'd like to start with an homage to one of the great French sinologists. And of course, if we're talking about Taoism, the obvious candidate would be Henri Maspero, who was a man referred to as l'homme de Chine antique. For the book that he wrote in 1926, but after his early interest in ancient China, he turned his attention to Taoism, not to the classic of the way and virtue, but rather to later Taoist text. But nonetheless, a man who has exerted great influence over the field of Taoist studies in the West, and because of the Western influence on Taoist studies, also on China. This is a case of a reimportation. The Chinese scholars had, in some fashion, lost touch with the Taoist tradition in China, but having found it fascinating to foreign scholars, they took up the study again in their own right. Just to refresh your memory about the Tao Te Ching, the De Tao Jing, the Laozi, however we want to refer to this particular text, and I think throughout the lecture I will probably refer to it as the Laozi, because it's supposed to have been written by a man named Laozi, for want of a better name for him, perhaps Lao Dan, who was a historiographer, or at least a scribe, at the Zhou court near Luoyang in the 6th century BC. At least this is the tradition in China, as we find it, for instance, in the Shiji of Sima Qian. And as the story goes, Confucius paid a visit to Lao Dan to ask him for instruction in the rites. Because of that, the Chinese tradition is that this book was written by Laozi. You probably know the story that he was deciding to leave China and passing through the Western Pass, and the gatekeeper asked him to write down his life philosophy, and he did it in an evening. The text is not very long. It's 5,000 characters, more or less. And it has come to us in 81 chapters, a figure that we might want to keep in mind throughout the lecture. I decided to talk about the Tao Te Ching, about the Laozi today, rather than one of the other Confucian classics. And there's really much to say about the other Confucian classics as well, particularly the Chunqiu, I think is tremendously important for understanding the development of the Chinese historiographical tradition. The ritual text have surfaced in rather great profusion in the tombs of China over the last 50 years, really, even longer than for the other texts. So there would be much to say about those texts, but it seems to me that the debates that have raged about the Laozi over the course of the last century are sort of symptomatic of the debates that have taken place about all of the reconstitution of ancient Chinese tradition over the course of this century. And so I thought that this would provide a fitting conclusion to the series of lectures. And if we talk about the Laozi and the modern reception, or the modern reading of the Laozi, probably the place to start is with the figure on your left, Hu Shi, who returned to China from the United States in 1915. And he was named the professor at Peking University. You can see that's a photograph of him at the time. This appointment created great controversy in Beijing because, first of all, he was very young. Second of all, he was trained in the West and not in China. And people thought that for him to be named the professor of Chinese philosophy at Peking University was really a travesty. But he quickly developed a circle of students, really disciples, around him. And the most important of them is the young man on the right, Gu Jiagang. And we'll hear his name again throughout the lecture. But Hu Shi began lecturing at Peking University, and scandalized many people because he said that there was no writing in China, certainly no, there were no books before about 700 BC. And he said the classic of poetry was the first book that people began to write. And then a few years later, I think it was in 1918, 1919, that, of course, this was at a time when Hu Shi was turning his attention to other topics, such as modern Chinese literature and how to write the Chinese language. He is the one of the principal advocates of writing in the vernacular that has come to be known as the May 4th movement in China. But just at that time, he published his first book on Chinese philosophy, on the history. It's called An Outline of History of Chinese Philosophy. 中国哲学史大纲. And in that book, he started with the first chapter on Lao Tzu, and then the second chapter on Confucius. And this too was created something of a controversy in China. Hu Shi did this not primarily for historical reasons, but rather for polemical reasons. He was more taken with the philosophy of Lao Tzu than with the philosophy of Confucius, and indeed in many ways wanted to overthrow Confucian philosophy and the effects that it was having on modern China. But he still made the argument, well, in the historical records of Sima Qian, it says that Confucius visited Lao Tzu, therefore Lao Tzu is older than Confucius, so Lao Tzu should go first. This was, as I say, not welcome to all scholars, and indeed, perhaps the most influential intellectual, public intellectual of the day, a man named Liang Qichao, wrote a review of Hu Shi's book, and the review takes up about 90% of the review is addressed to the question of the date of the Lao Tzu. The other 10% takes up the rest of Hu Shi's book. And in his review, he argued almost as a legal case against the Lao Tzu, saying that this book is a forgery, that it's not from the 6th century BC prior, so Lao Tzu was not an elder contemporary of Confucius, the book was not written at that time, but rather is much later. And I've listed for you here just a sort of point-by-point summation of some of the evidence that Liang Qichao adduced in support of his argument against the Lao Tzu. He says, for instance, that the biography of Lao Tzu in the Shiji of Sima Qian is confused. Of course, if we threw out everything that is confused in the Shiji, we would have to throw out a good portion of the book. He says there, in addition, from the time of Confucius down to the Han Dynasty, there were 13 generations of Confucius's descendants, but if we count from Lao Dan in the 6th century BC down to the beginning of the Han Dynasty, there are only 8 generations. And maybe Lao Tzu, the name, is the old boy, is particularly long-lived, but it's unreasonable to think that generation after generation could be considerably more long-lived than Confucius's own disciples. He said that some of the texts that we know to have been written in the intervening period, and he mentions the Lun Yu, the Muozi, the Mencius, so texts that traditionally we would think were written in the 5th and 4th century BC, never mentioned the Lao Tzu. So if this book were in fact in circulation beginning already in the 6th century BC, how is it that books of the 5th and 4th century don't mention it? He says that the story about Confucius going and asking Lao Tzu for instruction about the rites is ridiculous, because the position that Lao Tzu takes in the book, the Lao Tzu or the Tao Te Ching, is strictly antithetical to the rites. He says that the rites are a cause of society's problems. So why would Confucius seek instruction from someone who had that view of the rites? And then finally, he said, well, the thought in the Lao Tzu is not consistent with what we know of the thought of the 6th century BC. And what is more, the language of the book is not consistent with the language that we know for the 6th century BC. And this attack on the Lao Tzu was taken up by many of the young intellectuals of the day, the young historians of Chinese philosophy, whose names have now become almost synonymous with the study of Chinese philosophy for us. Qian Mu, Feng Youlan, Gu Jiegang, just to name three. These are the greatest names in 20th century scholarship about Chinese philosophy. And one by one, they wrote articles attacking, first of all, the Lao Tzu, and then indirectly attacking also Hu Shi, who, even though he was Gu Jiegang's student, by the time Gu Jiegang wrote his long study of the Lao Tzu, he had broken with his teacher. And there was a public debate between the two of them. But all three of these, and several other figures, during the mid-1920s and the early 1930s, wrote articles arguing that the Lao Tzu could not have been written. Not only could it not have been written in the 6th century BC, but it couldn't have been written before the 3rd century. And Gu Jiegang even went so far as to say perhaps into the 2nd century BC. And to focus on Gu Jiegang, partially because he was the student of Hu Shi, partially because his study of the date of the Lao Tzu was the longest and most detailed, and partially because he was the editor of a series of books called Gu Shi Bian, or debates on ancient history that collected the writings of many of the most prominent intellectuals in China during the period 1924 to 1937. It was published in 7 volumes over that 13-year period. And his conclusion, I deeply suspect that the Lao Tzu is neither the words of a single man nor the work of a single time, but was compiled over a lengthy period. The notion of books not being written by a single man, and certainly not in a single evening, as Lao Tzu was waiting to go through the pass, but rather is a view that books come together in an accretional way, little by little, passage by passage, being added either to the end of a book or perhaps in the middle somewhere, a view of the composition of ancient Chinese books that has become particularly influential in the West today. And then he says, as for the time of its completion, at the earliest was probably the end of the Warring States, which would be mid-3rd century BC, or else at the beginning of the Western Han, into the 2nd century BC. Just before Gu Jiegang died, he died in 1980, and just before he died, he wrote an article on why he had edited the Gu Shibian books back in the 1920s and 30s, these debates on ancient history. And I think this really gives considerable insight into his motivations. His scholarship was in part the scholarship of a scientific historian, somebody who is weighing the evidence and trying to determine what the value of the evidence should be. But on the other hand, of course, we know that all historians are motivated. They have their reasons for doing history as they do it. And Gu Jiegong, in this 1979 article, came clean with his motivations for having written the books that he did. And he says that it was a revolutionary, a contribution to the revolution. He wanted to overthrow imperialism abroad and to overthrow feudalism at home. And feudalism, of course, means Confucianism. And my work with Gu Shibian was intended to smash thoroughly feudalism. That was the important thing. With Gu Shibian, he wasn't going to overthrow imperialism abroad, but to smash feudalism at home. And then he goes on to say, and this sort of resonates with some of the things that we heard about the Classic of Documents 2 weeks ago. I wanted to make ancient books just ancient books and not to be modern knowledge, that they have nothing to teach us today. I wanted to make ancient history just ancient history and not to be modern politics or theory. And I wanted to make ancient people just ancient people and not to be authorities of modern thought. So he wanted to overthrow the sages of antiquity. In other words, I wanted to organize properly the religious feudal classics. At the time that he's writing, 1979, all of those terms were very loaded terms. Religious, which you could translate as superstitious. Feudal, which is traditional or Confucian. Classics, these things that are supposed to be authoritative, but of course by then were no longer regarded as classics. And the classics, and send them to the Museum of Feudalism to cut away their dignity so that the old thoughts could no longer continue into the new age. I think that really is an important insight into the debates that were taking place in the 1920s and 30s about the Laozi, and indeed that it's an important insight into all of 20th century historiography on ancient China. As I just mentioned, this is not particularly new in the 1920s and 30s. We, people in the West, I think of it as being a new development of the 1920s because that's when Western scholars began to be aware of what was going on in China. So that's when Henri Maspero published La Chine Antique. And of course, many of us have this very, very naive view that before we were born, nothing really happened. So that there were no developments like this in China until Western scholars began to be aware of it. But already in the 17th century, Chinese scholars were raising similar kinds of doubts about the history of the Laozi. And then in about 1800, a person named Cui Shu wrote a long and very detailed attack on the Laozi. Although it didn't have any influence on China until the 1920s, because it was a book that survived in manuscript form, and it was only through the efforts of Hu Shi, ironically enough, that it was resuscitated and then published to have a wider circulation. So I just wanted to mention that this is not an entirely new development of the 1920s, but it's still really a crystallization of 20th century views on ancient China. In 1931, Hu Shi, who had started this attack on feudalism, who is the great advocate of the May 4th movement, who also intended to overthrow Confucianism. But he took a step back from what he had been doing in the 19-teens, and he said he'd actually learned something. Most professors don't learn very much in the course of their teaching, but Hu Shi said that he was paying attention to the discoveries at Anyang. He's writing in 1931, and excavations at Anyang began in 1928. And he was astounded to find that there was a mature bronze culture, civilization, that the archaeologists dated to 1200 BC, or even into before 1200 BC. And he said, of course, he also paid attention to the oracle bone inscriptions and realized that this was a literate society. And his previous view that there was no writing in China prior to 700 BC, he couldn't reconcile that with these discoveries. And so he wanted to step back from his previous assertions on the sort of recent birth of China. Of course, he also wanted to defend his own book that had just gone through about 10 years of criticism and why he should have put the Laozi first. But he wrote the book, and it was published in 1933, but I'm pretty sure that it actually was, this article was written in 1931 or maybe 1932, right? Somehow I seem to recall that the date on it was New Year's Day of one of those years. The article was actually published in the Harvard Journal of Asiatic Studies, one of the very first publications of that journal in 1937. So it's available in English. But Hu Shi, let him speak for himself here. So he says, during the last 10 years or so, several of our scholars whom I respect and admire have come to doubt seriously the date assigned to the man Laozi and the book which bears the title Laozi. That's a fair assessment of the kinds of critiques that had been leveled against his own work and, of course, against the Laozi. He said, I don't oppose this attitude of skepticism. Indeed, he had created the attitude of skepticism in some respects in China of the day. But then he says, I only wish that the skeptics could display sufficient evidence to make us consent willingly to the shifting of Laozi or the book Laozi to a later date. After reading all of the evidence that Liang Qichao, Qian Mu, Feng Yulan, Gu Jiagong had adduced for arguing that the Laozi should be dated to the 3rd century BC, I still don't see sufficient evidence. And then he mentioned, in addition to the discoveries at Anyang, of course, the discoveries at Dunhuang that had been made at the very beginning of the 20th century, but were only then coming into to circulation among scholars. He said that with the discovery of books there, we have found that our notions of the development of Chinese literature are a little bit retarded, which I mean literally, that they're too late, that we thought that Chinese theater, for instance, didn't begin until the Yuan Dynasty. But now we find already manuscripts at Dunhuang where there are sort of dramatic episodes from the Tang Dynasty. And then he concludes this paragraph that the skeptical attitude is to be encouraged, but more to be encouraged is the capacity for the suspension of judgment pending the appearance of sufficient evidence. I changed this talk yesterday, and I decided to learning a little bit about how to use PowerPoint. And one of the things I found is that you can actually change the color of the font. And I decided to highlight that in red. That I think is something that we should all keep in mind, that the capacity for the suspension of judgment is a really important capacity for scholars and for people in general. And then his conclusion, hate to say that Hu Shi was what we would call a weasel, somebody who tries to back out of a controversy, but in fact, after writing a very long article, he says, well, I don't have time to really give my own ideas about this. But he can say this much, he's never yet found sufficient evidence to make it imperative to shift the date to the period of the Warring States or to the latter part of that period. And then once again, his idea, until such evidence has been discovered, all that we can do is prolong the period of investigation and postpone the day of judgment. Until such evidence, sufficient evidence, has been discovered. The problem is, what constitutes sufficient evidence? Some people find a little bit of evidence and say, that's enough, that's conclusive. Other people say, we need more, we need more. Over the course of the last 40 years, there has been considerable more evidence discovered concerning the book, the Laozi. Hu Shi, of course, was looking at the Dunhuang manuscripts and also taking into account the oracle bone inscriptions discovered at Anyang. But the evidence that has been discovered over the last 40 years has been much more direct. Oops. I did want to include this because there is a book, a scholar in America who wrote a book on the Analects of Confucius in which he proposes this accretional theory of how the book came together. But then he's also written a long book review in which he dates all the various texts. And of course, he dates the Laozi to the 3rd century BC. But he has a footnote, and it's about Hu Shi's attitude on the Laozi. And Bruce Brooks' summary judgment of Hu Shi's attitude is that it's a great man making a fool of himself by attacking a scientific historian, by which he means Liang Qichao, and scientific history as such, in defense of what everyone of consequence now agrees was a mere nursery tale. Everyone of consequence agrees to that. So that if you don't agree to that, then you're of no consequence. Now, just having left that as a certain point of polemics, move on to the archaeological discoveries. And the first is one that we talked about in the very first week of these lectures, the discovery at Ma Wang Dui in Changsha, Hunan, 1973. This picture is very reminiscent of the work that was done at Anyang in the 1930s. Archaeology hadn't developed very much in China between the 1930s and the 1970s. But this discovery, probably as much as the discoveries at Anyang, served to propel Chinese archaeology to the forefront of the popular imagination, in part because there were three tombs at Anyang. And the first tomb that was discovered in 1971 was the tomb of a woman, Lady Dai, and I'm sure you've all seen the casket and the banner that that was covering the casket that portrays the stages of life of this woman as she dies and goes down into the Yellow Springs, and then as she also goes up into heaven and sloughs off her mortal body and takes her place among the stars and the sun and the moon. But more important for our topic today was in tomb three in 1973, the tomb of Lady Dai's son, in which, in addition to a manuscript of the I Ching that I introduced to you 3 weeks ago, there were not one but two manuscripts of the Laozi. One of them written in rather older character. The date of the tomb, we know, is 168 BC, so that the manuscripts had to have been copied prior to that date. Of course, when were they copied is a question. Based on the calligraphy and the use of characters, most people think that this particular manuscript was copied about 200 BC or slightly earlier, so just before the Han Dynasty. There was a second manuscript, and it was probably copied about 175 BC, which is to say, shortly before the tomb, it was put into the tomb. These were very luxurious copies done on silk. Of course, at this time, 1973, when this was discovered, people had in mind the ancient formulation written on bamboo and silk, and thought that silk was a more or less common medium for books in antiquity. We've now discovered, after 40 years of continuing discovery, that silk was very rare for books, so that these were deluxe copies of these texts. Unfortunately, silk doesn't survive very well underground. It doesn't survive. That bamboo doesn't necessarily survive very well. Silk even less well. And this was folded into and placed in hampers. Unfortunately, at all the places where the silk was folded, it frayed, and that's why you see these holes in the text. But two manuscripts almost complete, and in China, people thought that this constituted evidence to be sure that the text was intact by no later than 200 BC. It would be hard to argue with that, but that it also suggested a much earlier date for the text. But because these were found in a Han Dynasty tomb after the date of the Qin burning of the books, it still didn't constitute any evidence for what the text may have been like before the time of Qin Shi Huang. So people have been waiting with bated breath, I suppose you could say, for something, some evidence prior to 221 BC, 213 BC, the date of the burning of the books, 221, the date of Qin Shi Huang's unification of the states, or preferably even back into the 4th century BC. 20 years later, they got their wish. 1993, the tomb at Guodian that I mentioned last week with respect to the classic of poetry. And here is a picture of the bamboo strips as they were first taken out of the tomb and sort of disassembled. You can see that they turned black and by all appearances are illegible. But then when they get published, they have a technique to be able to restore the color of the original bamboo, and the ink is fantastic. It's still perfectly clear now, 2,300 years after the time of the writing of these texts. And we know that these texts were written about 300 BC. And so there is an illustration of what these texts look like on the right as you find them in the publication that was made public in 1998. And the important thing about the Guodian Laozi is that there were three different manuscripts in this corpus that include entirely material that is found in the received text of the Laozi. What does this mean? Is this sufficient evidence for deciding the date of the Laozi? It depends on your point of view, I suppose. I enjoyed this. This too was in a footnote. Footnotes are often fun to read in scholarly articles because they allow a little bit of insight into the background of what people are thinking about. And this Wang Bo is the chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Peking University today. And he was writing just about 2000, so just after these Guodian manuscripts were first published. And almost immediately after they were published, there was a meeting held in the United States and brought together about half of the participants from China and about half from Europe and America. And this is a comment that he made on this, and he said that the different scholars, perhaps it's unavoidable that they should have different backgrounds and methods, and that he was generous enough to say that the Western scholars probably viewed the Chinese scholars as being extremely bold, but lacking a critical spirit. And conversely, the Chinese scholars were baffled by a number of views of the Western scholars. And then he mentions one in particular. He says that 5 years before this, sometime in the mid-1990s, he was in Germany attending a Laozi conference, and Professor Christoph Harbsmeyer, who is a professor at the University of Oslo in Norway, and who very much enjoys, I shouldn't say he enjoys sitting in bars, but he enjoys being in bars and talking about these kinds of academic questions, and gets very energized by these sorts of questions. And he brought up to Wang Bo, he said, since Qianmu long ago, in the 1920s, already proved that the Laozi is later than the Zhuangzi, which is turning upside down the history of Taoist thought. We typically view the Laozi as being the first text of the Taoist tradition, and then the Zhuangzi follows it. But Qianmu actually wrote a book in which he says that the Zhuangzi should come before the Laozi. So Qianmu already proved this. Why do you Chinese scholars still believe that the Laozi is prior to the Zhuangzi? And Wang Bo said at first he thought that this was just Christoph Harbsmeyer being Professor Harbsmeyer. But then he later discovered that many Western sinologists hold the same view. And in the West, Gu Shibian, these publications of the 1920s and 30s are still regarded almost as scripture, that these are authoritative sources for the study of ancient Chinese thought. But in contemporary China, most people regard the Gu Shibian scholarship as of only historical interest, that it tells us how we got to where we are now, but we wouldn't go back to read Gu Shibian to try and find any real evidence. And then he mentions a collection of Professor Li Xueqin's that is leaving behind the iconoclastic period, Zou Chu Yi Gu Shi Dai, that we have now left iconoclasm, and some people in China have entered into the believing antiquity period, though Professor Li himself would not say that. He says that we should try to understand antiquity. Rather than trying to overthrow it, let's try to understand it. And Wang Bo says the reason that we have walked out of this iconoclastic period is precisely because we have discovered so many of these manuscripts from antiquity. But as I say, there are two different perspectives for any of this evidence, and so what constitutes sufficient evidence is always a problem. When the Guodian manuscripts were discovered, one of the most prominent historians of Chinese philosophy, and particularly of Taoism in China, a man named Chen Guying, who at the time was a professor at Peking University. He's now back in Taiwan. But he gave a summary judgment that so that if we look at these bamboo these three groups of bamboo strips and compare them with the Ma Wangdui text and the received text, even though the chapter sequences are different, the content is fundamentally the same, and this destroys the scholarly theory that has been popular for the last several decades that the Laozi was created by a long process of editing. So this theory seems to be mistaken, since later people merely added individual words to the text, but its contents underwent no great change in the course of its transmission. And there's no way to say that contemporary Chinese views of ancient history are monolithic, there's one view that everyone holds, but this would be the general view. Certainly you can find people who would take exception to it, but I think many Chinese scholars would find Chen Guying's statement here to be generally correct. In the West, on the other hand, professor at the University of Washington, William Boltz, wrote a study in, I think, about 2003 or 2000, yeah, 2003, I think. And he says that the Guodian manuscripts prove exactly the opposite. Rather than claiming that this is an early version of the Laozi, we can only argue that this is a collection of passages that came over the course of the third century to be mixed in an unpredictable sequence with an approximately equal number of passages not seen in these manuscripts, ending up as a mixtum compositum that has been transmitted as the Laozi. So that the earliest evidence that we have of a complete Laozi remains the Ma Wangdui manuscripts of about 200 BC. And so he says that the Guodian passages may be thought of as a kind of pre-Laozi textual raw material, textual building block, so to speak, out of which a part of the work we know as the Laozi later crystallized, but they do not themselves constitute a version of the Laozi proper in any textually meaningful sense. And then he says, seeing the Guodian Laozi passages this way agrees in general with the prevailing view that the transmitted Laozi took its fixed textual form in the middle to late 3rd century BC, based on as yet indeterminate extent on passages that were in general circulation as aphorisms and anecdotes, sayings and teachings, or other staccato textual material, sometimes associated with a particular name or school, sometimes not. That's a mouthful, but what he's saying there is that no one of consequence would regard the Laozi as being any earlier than the 3rd century BC, that this agrees in general with the prevailing view. I don't know what the prevailing view is in the West. Probably, if you were to take a vote, it would be about 51% in favor of Bolz's view here, 49% opposed, or maybe it would be 10 people voting yes here and 7 or 8 voting no, and many of the rest of the people saying, I abstain until there's more evidence. And indeed, in 2005, I published a study of the historiography of the Laozi in the 20th century, and had gone back and reread all of the scholarship over the course of the century, and was really very impressed with Hu Shi and his attitude, and wanted to try and restate that for the 21st century. And weighing the Chinese, Chen Guoying's approach to the Guodian manuscripts as opposed to Bill Bolz's approach, I think that the Guodian manuscripts still don't constitute sufficient evidence. It's wonderful evidence. It's certainly worth consideration. But does it resolve the question of whether these are quotations from a complete Laozi, or they're simply the building blocks from which the Laozi later crystallized? I don't know how you really adjudicate that. And then it, again yesterday, I found that way of using red. It seems to me that much of the initial scholarship devoted to the manuscripts, despite the assurance with which the more extreme positions are stated, tells us more about the historiography of the 20th century than it does about the intellectual history of the 4th century BC or before that. So I wanted to use this as a way of framing the study of the Chinese classics over the 20th century, and to show that these are questions that are of interest not only in China, but certainly in the West as well, among scholars of ancient China, but I think also of scholars of modern China. The classics are never really dead. I would have stopped here when I was first proposing this to Professor Cheng, but in March, and towards the end of March, I received the latest publication, which is of a set of manuscripts that is in the possession of Peking University. And the very first publication that they have issued is a manuscript of the Laozi. It doesn't really constitute sufficient evidence for the questions that we've been talking about today, because it dates to about 100 BC or so. But it's beautiful. I had seen this, I think, 3 years ago in Beijing, but seeing it in the book, you can really, really appreciate the calligraphy. And it's almost complete. It's about 5,400 characters, of which there are perhaps 60 characters missing because of broken bamboo strips. So it is. It calls itself the Laozi Shangjing and the Laozi Xiajing, the upper classic and the lower classic. And this is why I titled today's lecture Unearthing the Classic of Virtue and the Way, because here, as in the Ma Wangdui manuscript, it's very clear that the sequence of the Laozi is reversed. So the second half of the book comes first, and the first half of the book, the famous Dao Ke Dao Fei Chang Dao that we all know about, is actually in the middle of the book. This is the portion that I'm going to show you a couple more slides that will magnify this a little bit so you can appreciate the calligraphy a little more. But you can see from this the state of preservation of this manuscript on bamboo strips from 100 BC absolutely beautiful. The calligraphy is in a very formal clerical script that you can read easily. Anyone who knows modern Chinese really could read this text. So this is the very first strip, Shang De Bu De Shi Yi. Shows you the calligraphy. On the back of strip number 2, actually, is where it has the title of the text. So this is the Laozi Shang Jing, the upper classic, dividing the classic into two parts. And it also provides, as do many ancient manuscripts, a count of the number of characters in the text. Here, 2,942 is just for the first half of the text. Here is the famous Dao Ke Dao Fei Chang Dao, or as we now know, it should be Dao Ke Dao Fei Heng Dao Ye. And just an opportunity to see how the calligraphy is on this. And then this has account for the number of characters in the back of this, 2,303, I believe it is. The book is, actually I'm not sure, is it Shanghai Guji Chubansha? It's either Shanghai Guji Chubansha or a new press that is a subsidiary of the Guji called the Zhongxi Shuju in Shanghai. But it's published to the very highest standards and includes really excellent scholarship. And in the back of the book, there is this table that compares all of the manuscripts and early text of the Laozi that have some sort of claim to contributing towards the transmission of the text. I know you can't see this from where you are. Here is a magnification of it, but it compares what they call the Han Jianbun, the Han Dynasty text, the Guodian text, the Ma Wang Dui A manuscript, the Ma Wang Dui B manuscript, and then it goes on and compares the Wang Bi text, the He Shang Gong text, the Xiang'er manuscript, and the Fuyi, the ancient manuscript that was probably discovered in the 5th century AD. So it's really a great convenience to us in terms of doing any sort of textual comparison. And then there's one more thing. We have one more minute before Cinderella finds the coach turn into a pumpkin. It just turned. Too late. One of the great things about having manuscripts on silk or bamboo is that we get a sense of the physicality of the book in ancient China. And from this, we find out how this text was bound, so that, yes, I have this somewhere. We have these marks here. These were little notches cut into the bamboo to allow the binding strap to pass through there and hold it firmly in place. So that's one of the things that we can use these for. This is not particularly new, but something really quite new is that a young student, he was actually a second year student in the archaeology department at Peking University, but was helping to clean the strips and to work with them. And unlike the professors who were looking at the front side of the strip with the characters on them, he turned the strips over and he found on strip after strip, there was a little scratch, and nobody else had ever noticed this scratch, but then he pieced the strips back together, and here because the Laozi is a transmitted text and we know the sequence of the strips. So it was possible to put them back in the order. And when he did, he found that these lines match up in a diagonal across the strips and allow us to see the sequence of the strips. And this is particularly important for many manuscripts in which the sequence is debated. And then this is an imagination, but since this was first published 2 years ago, just 2 years ago, people have looked at all of the early bamboo strip materials discovered in the 1980s and 90s and the first part of the 2000s and discovered that all of those that are authentic have the same kind of diagonal mark on the back. And it's caused people then to think, why was this produced? How was it produced? And the current thinking is that before the bamboo was even cut into strips, someone took a knife and just made a mark around it to indicate how the strips would lie flat once they were cut into strips. That's interesting for the production of books in antiquity, but what is particularly useful is that this is a more or less foolproof test for the authenticity of those materials that have been robbed from tombs from the period of 1990 roughly down to, and it stops unfortunately in 2011, because as soon as this article was published, then any forger worth his salt would put the same kind of strip on the back of the strips. But anyways, for those, we know that they're authentic. And so this new publication, just from March of this year, an absolutely beautiful deluxe publication, it doesn't constitute sufficient evidence to resolve the question of the date of the Laozi, but it does show the ongoing interest in China and I hope here in Paris as well with regard to the unearthing the Chinese classics. Thank you very much.